You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada, because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade.
A few weeks ago, the From Embers crew took a road trip out east for the Halifax Anarchist Book Fair and to visit friends and family. While we were there, we had the opportunity to visit the treaty camp established by Mi'kmaq people to protect the Shubenacadie River in central Nova Scotia. In 2016, grassroots Mi'kmaq people in the area were surprised to learn that Calgary-based Alton Gas had started construction on a massive natural gas storage project on the river. Alton Gas intends to use large natural salt caverns 1 kilometer underground to store this natural gas. To do this, they plan to build a pipeline to take water from the Shubenacadie River, run it through the caverns to dissolve the salt, and then dump the salty water back into the river. They plan to do this to up to 20 salt caverns, and they are betting on the Nova Scotia government lifting the current moratorium on fracking and for fracking activities to massively increase in that province. In response, grassroots Mi'kmaq people established the treaty camp at the Alton construction site on Labor Day weekend in 2016. Since then, water protectors have established a treaty truck house on the river, built a straw bale house blocking the access road, and conducted ceremonies at the river. The site has been shut down for just over 2 years, and it was very inspiring to visit. I got the chance to sit down with Dale, who is one of the people holding down the camp on a daily basis. Dale cut his teeth at another reclamation camp back in 2013, when Mi'kmaq people led a successful struggle against fracking activities in Rexton, New Brunswick, despite a violent clash in October of that year, sparked by a heavily armed police raid that led to serious charges for many. Dale describes daily life at the camp, tells some funny stories, and opens up about the importance of ceremony, where he gets his strength, and his take on the future of this world. I really enjoyed hanging out with him, and I hope you find it as inspiring as I do.
Dale Pullet, Iskasawani First Nation, Cape Breton, Unamagi.
How did you come to be here?
I would say helping out, got asked to help out up here. A lot of what I know is like probably from Rexton experience up there.
Would you be able to talk a bit about that experience?
Rexton, there's a lot of things going on up there. I basically just kept the camp open and just whatever I could do, whatever I was good at, splitting wood or fold up blankets, dry them, wash them. End up getting in trouble up there for things I didn't do. And how was it?
So the truck house was the first place where people were living here in terms of the reclamation of the land here?
Yeah. Truck house was built for a place to gather, I guess. And the only, like I said, my experience from Rexton is if you want to protest something like this anyway, you got to keep the camp open. And that's what I volunteered to do, is stay there all winter and keep the camp open. Mm-hmm. But I already know from Rexton that the camp is in the wrong spot. It should be at the front, right here. Like they did in Rexton, they put their camp right in front of the where the trucks were.
Blocking the access for the construction equipment, right?
Yeah.
So the Treaty Truck House is down at on the Shubenacadie River, is that right?
Yeah, right against the river.
Someone told me it was in the treaty, like in the Peace and Friendship Treaty, that Mi'kmaq people could set up a truck house wherever they needed to monitor any kind of activity that was going on. Did I understand that right?
Yeah, that's pretty right. So a lot of the treaty is what built that and is keeping us from getting shut down.
Would you be able to explain sort of where that treaty came from and what kind of relationship it teaches us?
When the first Europeans arrived 250 some odd years ago, they had to form a treaty because the Mi'kmaq people were too strong. So the British wanted to, peace and friendship so they can settle here. And we agreed to that and we wrote those treaties here at the river. Mm-hmm. And according to my father, that his great-great-great-grandfather is one of them who signed the last treaties on the Shubenacadie River.
So this camp was established 2016?
The one at the river was 2016 fall.
And so was there a big event when that first happened? Like, did a bunch of people come down and together?
Yeah, there was a lot of events, like almost on a daily, almost. And people went down there to assert rights, fishing, and have gatherings and ceremonies, and shared a lot of food and a lot of knowledge. Talked about ways to stop this company. And then they built the truck house in like 2 days or a day or something like that.
The communities that were involved in starting it, where are they based?
All over.
Yeah.
Majority of them from Indian Brook.
How far is that from here?
Probably a 20-minute drive. And Millbrook's probably like another 20 minutes that way, so it's two different reserves. Mm-hmm.
And so does the camp have the support of the majority of those communities, would you say?
Yeah.
Do they have band councils there?
They do.
And do they also support it? Or?
They're not allowed.
Right. So it's more of a grassroots.
Yeah.
More of a grassroots thing.
Yeah, the INAC system is, they're told by these governments or maybe it's the oil and gas, I don't know, but they're told not to get involved with any protests or any blockade or even to talk about these kind of things on Facebook and share or like statuses about these fights, or probably even told not to add them, add people like me on Facebook.
Has a lot of the organizing in terms of reaching out to people, has that been on Facebook? Is that your main kind of public platform?
Facebook is a tool. Mm-hmm. It's a really good communication tool, and it holds people accountable in some ways, video. And then the other half would be, people actually showing up here and pre-planning things. I don't like the Facebook actually myself for a couple of reasons. Too much negativity goes on there, and you read other people's posts and comments, and you kind of pick up the vibes. People like to get brave behind a computer screen. So Facebook is a good tool, but it can also be a devastating tool. Mm-hmm. So the best way to, I think, communicate or to get things, questions and answers, is to go right directly to the people involved and directly to the camp itself.
Have you had a lot of visitors come by here?
We get lots of visitors, yeah.
Can you tell us some of the kinds of people who come by and what some of the relationships look like?
Professors and teachers and classes themselves. 100 kids come here one day. Then there's group parties, there's different kind of groups. And Solidary Halifax got groups, and these anarchists come by, and Montrealers come by, and people from BC and all across Turtle Island. Yeah, you get all kinds of people. Even like, one lady, Josephine Mandemum, I think I said her name wrong, her last name, but she came here a couple times. She's from Ontario. She did her water walk. She also like inspired others to do it. That's important when people like that come to resistance camps and acknowledge what's going on here. Is very important. It says a lot. It's meaningful. And then, you know, there's other people that come here and they do ceremonies like pipe ceremony and water pondu, and they bring those teachings from out west. That's our culture. That's been hidden for the past 300-400 years. A lot of our culture went underground because we knew the settlers were coming through ceremonies. We knew what was to happen. We made those sacrifices for our future generations. And it's always about the next seven generations. So when people come here and say, I'm here for the river, well, really, you're here for the next seven generations. Because water is life, like they say. Along with those people that come here, there's a lot of wisdom and knowledge and stories. And then they talk about their struggle and we relate. And it's not even First Nations too. It's like there's a lot of non-natives that come by. They're already oppressed with their own government. So it says a lot right there, you know. And some people come here to vent on their own government and say how corrupt and dirty it is. And they have no hope for the world because they know this place is falling apart. And I can guarantee that there will be a future for our children. I can guarantee that one. Because of our spirituality, our beliefs, our ceremonies. But it's really like we're put on earth, I believe, to do our job. And sometimes we get distracted or mentally, emotionally stressed out and stuff like that. But always got to have good faith and just be humble. Having good faith, even like doing this thing would be like pointless if you don't have faith in the future. So this is why I do it anyway. I don't know about anybody else. I can't speak for other people, but I can tell you what I believe in and why I do it. And, like, I'll tell you a little bit about my father. His name is Andrew Lafford. Everybody knows him as Face. That's his nickname. And my dad was an alcoholic before I was born. And he was fed up. He was fed up with the way things were going, and he knew his people were in such a struggle. And he's a residential school survivor too, so you could see like how much oppression and all of that hurt my father went through growing up, and then had to deal with me. And I'm mad and angry and confused and frustrated, and I'm punching holes in the wall because I'm mad at the world, and my dad's, you know, right calm, and he's trying to keep me calm. I always think about my dad. Like, when I get frustrated, I just think about him and what he went through, and I try to imagine like residential school for him as a kid or a youngster. And my father Sundanced for 30 years over 30 years. It's a sacred ceremony that they go 4 days without food and water. And their commitment to these ways are 100%, meaning they don't mess around with drugs, women, mess with water, they don't fool around with tobacco, they don't disrespect anything. And they're devoted 100%. And I just listened to his stories, and then he actually took me up when I was 13. That's when I started going up. And I see in exactly everything they go through, from fasting to Sundancing to doctrines to namings to marriage. And then I seen all of that, and I witnessed what they went through. And 4 days without food and water is pretty hardcore. And, you know, then on top of that, they pierced themselves through their chest. And they do it again next year, and they prepare themselves. So every time they prepare themselves for a fast or a Sundance, they commit 1 year without playing with water, playing with tobacco, swearing, fighting, arguing, you know, anything to do with the outside world or trying to live a comfortable life. You know, they teach them how to be humble and how to do these ceremonies properly. And it's a big commitment. And you know, my father goes through all that just for me and then my children. I'm not a sun dancer. I'm not a pipe carrier because I know the responsibility that comes with it. And I know, like, a lot about those ways because I paid attention basically up in South Dakota every time I went up there. Watched them, helped them take those people out fast and listen to their stories when they're done. That kind of puts in my mind the humble part and the commitment. Like, they commit so much and they have to sacrifice so much and they don't even complain about it. So that I do my best not to complain about anything, and just anytime I think about it, hard times or anything, oppression, I just start thinking of my dad and just remember those times he took me up there and all the miracles I witnessed up there, people with stage 4 cancer and coming back next year with full length of hair. It's amazing to see. Those ceremonies are powerful. So that's why I believe in it so much, that when they said that they had they went on this ceremony with this guy who went on a vision quest as a fast. So he went out to fast, and then he had a vision of 1,000 years ahead from today, and he seen the kids were still drinking water from the river. So that was his clarification that we're gonna be all right. This world is not going to ever end, and it's never going to, no apocalypse or nothing like that's going to happen. Who knows? Might be an EMP shut down the world and electricity goes out. And everybody has to, are forced to go back to the olden ways, and whatever knowledge you carry, man, it's going to be your sharpened stone and your knife to survival. So the first ceremonies that were given to us on land were the sweat lodge and the pipe and the medicine bundle. And there's proof of this because you can go to Kejimkujik and look at the petroglyphs on the ground, and you'll see the actual blueprints of a sweat lodge and the pipe and the star lodge, and there's a bunch of them. There's so many petroglyphs. And we had those ceremonies for a long time, and they were told, I guess, at one point to hide it underground, send them out west. And they did give them out west. They sent them out west, and I guess they end up in South Dakota, where they've been practicing them for years and years underground too, while the first settlers or whatever Europeans arrived and worked their way across Turtle Island. Here it was even against the law to do any of those ceremonies. Even a powwow was considered like outlawed. But then we got that right to practice them again, and I could say, like, those 30 years my father committed doing these ways, he's one of the reasons why it's coming back here, along with a lot of the pipe carriers that come here and support us. They know what they were doing. They're the true water protectors in my heart. Nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because they were told during Oka that they can go out there and fight with a gun, but if you go out there and fight with a gun, you better be ready to use it. And they didn't want to go that way. So they were told, all of them, that the pipe was more powerful than all the nuclear bombs combined. And that's their commitment, and they believe that.
Do the ceremonies out here, are they mostly to do with the river, or is it all kinds?
Mainly river, but there are other kinds, like the doctrines and keeping up the souls, releasing up the souls. people can go fast. And Sunday, just finished the Sundance. Like usually end of the hot summer season, this one, the Sundances start, so they're probably all done across wherever. But I mean, a main one that I know that happens a lot here would be the water bundle ceremony. That was also like brought from out west, the Shinabe, Josephine Madam, I think her name is, brought that ceremony down and taught a couple grandmothers up here how to do it, and they do it time to time.
Do you think we're going through a kind of resurgence in culture and ceremony, and like it seems like in the last 30 years there's been a lot of connections made across like Indigenous nations here, and certain flashpoints where people have stood up and taken reclaimed land. Do you think that we're in a moment where that's becoming more and more true?
I think so. It evolved. You could say that resistance camps evolved, and it's all thanks to people's sacrifices. You can go right down to and I'm talking like the resistance side of the movements and Native movements, like Anime Akwash, her sacrifices going up there and then getting murdered in our
Pine Ridge.
Pine Ridge, yes, Ogallala. And then you look at the next fight after that would be, I think, Oka or Burnt Church, then Donald Marshall, and then Rexton. And all of those didn't play out very well. But it got less and less violent as the fights progressed through time. And then now look at this one here. Now there's no cops. Now there's no, like, injunctions. Actually, the cops are like, you know, they're way different compared to Rexton. I can only talk about as far as back as Rexton. That's my only experience with camps. But the same thing here, the same thing up there. People came from all over the world just to pray. Ceremony. A lot of them went up there with pipes. I seen a lot of pipes. I met a lot of Sundancers. I even knew a few of them that went up there. It was funny too. I could tell you a funny story about this couple in Big Cove. When I was in Rexton, I was done building the longhouse, like a little shelter for people to sleep in, I guess. And this lady started talking to me, and she's like, she spoke Mi'kmaq, that's why I started talking to her. And she said, where I was from. I told her where I was from, and she's like, oh, okay. And she said, who are your parents? And I said, Gwen Pullet, it's my mother. And she looked at me, her eyes lit up, and she's like, Gwen? Gwen? Oh my goodness. And she's like, right, shocked and happy, and like, Gwen, that was my childhood best friend. We grew up together, we went to school together, went to college, and we stayed in a dorm together. We're drinking buddies, because my mom's known for drinking and all that. And I told her, I said, yeah, my mom just passed away that a year before that, I think, Rexton. She was like, oh, I'm sorry to hear that. And she's like, you got to meet my husband, Peter. And I was like, okay. And then I went to go see him, and he looked at me, and he said, he asked me in Mi'kmaq, like, where I'm from, and he said, who are your parents? And I told my father's face, and his eyes lit up when I said face. I didn't even say Andrew Lafford, I just said face. And he said, face? Really? Really? Your father's face? I said, I Sundanced with him. And I looked at him, and I said, fuck. I said, yeah, I do recognize you. And I said, I remember the first Sundance I went to, I was 13, and I remember my dad and this guy with white hair, long hair, looked just like you, speaking Mi'kmaq to each other while they're dancing. And I remembered that, and that's crazy, like how small world it is. This couple that just randomly met, and one was best friends with my mother, and the other one was a Sundancer brother, they called themselves brothers. You know, that's pretty amazing. I took that as a sign that I was on the right path up there, and I did that a lot. Like, little things like that happen a lot of times, and I was just take them as signs that, yeah, I'm doing something right. And always praying, like, if I do anything wrong, get me out of here safely.
You mentioned that the police have been more hands-off, I guess, here than they were in Rexton. Is that, do you think they're worried that another conflict will break out like it did in Rexton, or why do you think that is?
That's obvious too. Yeah, I believe that's exactly it. They don't want another conflict to break out, because we're on the home field of the Mi'kmaq people. In New Brunswick, that wasn't even the home field, and it was majority of that state there were from Cape Breton and Nova Scotia. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them that fought front lines, Warrior Society, were from Cape Breton. So we're like even closer to Cape Breton. We're like, yeah, we're in the backyard of all of the resistance people. Mm-hmm. In Halifax, we're like, you could look at Nova Scotia, Alton Gas site is in the center, dab smack in the center of all the communities in Halifax and everywhere.
How is the government responded to this situation? Do they say anything, or do they just avoid?
Avoid. At least they're honoring the treaties now, in some way, by not disturbing or hindering us during ceremony. But still, I'm keeping my guard up around here because I don't trust smear campaigns. That's always the one that takes down the camps, I notice, is camps getting smeared. Rexton would be a perfect example. Those cop cars getting on fire or self-ignited from inside. And yeah, that's all it took, was to create a big scene like that to shut them down, try to make them look bad. But instead it backfired on them, and it just created more attention, and it brought more people over there, and more people that were pissed off, they just kind of took things into their own hands and messed with the company their own ways in some way. The more people, the better, because there are so many charges given out to people and warriors and allies and non-natives, whoever, and I don't think there was enough money in the world for them to take on all those court cases. Mm-hmm. I know they dropped a lot of charges on a lot of people. That majority of the charges were scare tactics, that's all that was. And I can give you an example with this fight here. There was no police presence, but there was a security company that was trying to act like police. Mm-hmm. That were actually scaring grandmothers before they built the truck house, when they were telling them that they weren't allowed to cross the dike, they weren't allowed to go down to the river. But they were there, that wasn't stopping them.
Mighty near. Well, you may teach me this land's history, but we taught it to you first. We broke your hearts and bent your journeys. Broken treaties left us cursed. Even now, you have to cheat us. Even though you think us tame, in our losing, we found proudness. In your winning, you found shame. And there are drums beyond the mountains, Indian drums that you can't hear. There are drums beyond the mountains, and they're getting mighty near.
Yeah. This is M1, M.A. Uno, M.A. Dela Gente Comprende Entende, you feel me? I'm one half of Dead Prez, to tell it like it is, everything is political rap duo. Here holding my middle finger up to imperialism worldwide. And you in tune right now to the rebel beat.
The Rebel Beat is a monthly podcast of radical political music across different genres and across different continents. It's the mixtape to a riot against police brutality. It's your nightly newscast set to bass and beats. It's protest anthems from Hong Kong to Istanbul to Ferguson to Montreal. Give it a listen at rebelbeatradio.com or subscribe today on all your favorite podcast platforms.
Okay, I'm going to just tell the story.
Yeah, I hear this story.
So that night, I think it was October 5th, that's when I started staying at the truck house, and there was just a few of us. And my phone died. I was trying to get it charged all day, and I didn't have a charger, and my phone died, and I just had a funny feeling. And I told the girls, I said, what's your percentage on your battery? And they said, one of them said 5, and the other one said 2. And I said, off your phones, just in case. And they did. They offed their phones. And I went outside, started making a fire, and security were doing their thing. Like, every 25 minutes, two will get out of the box and then go right to the buildings, and then two will stay in there. And then I found it odd that they weren't doing that night. So I was just standing there, and finally I could hear a young man open the door, come out, and he was staggering. And so I ran in the truck house. I told the girls, I said, on your phones. I said, something's not right. I think they're messing with us. They're either drinking or they're doing something, trying to get us in trouble. So I ran back out, and then I see the boy. He was trying to get air, I guess. And then he went, tried to go back in, and he was staggering even worse. And so he went in, and I was listening. I was right against the fence listening because it was dark. But you could see, like, from inside they had a light, so you could see the boy. That's how I noticed him staggering. And then I heard him fall, ba-doom, and hit his head on the wall. Like, he must have fell, and then boom, smacked his head on the wall. And as soon as I got on the 911, I told them, I said, I think this guy is having a heart attack or something, and I want to help him, but I can't cross the fence because I'm protesting the gas company. And I got my first day training, and she said, hold on. So she went online with another person. I could hear them chit-chatting real quick, and then she got off, and then she said, yeah, cross the fence. Okay. And I went to the fence, and I told the security, can I cross? And they were like, yeah. So I went up there, and I was like, yeah. And he's looking pale, he's shaking, he's like half, he looks tired, and I was saying all that. Same time I'm talking, I'm examining how this happened, and I could tell the generator was pointed at the building with the exhaust pointing at this little tiny hole. So after the phone died, Trish got the other one and called the boy's mother, and the security, there was 4 of them that night. 3 of them had phones in their hands, and none of them called 911. What even made it more crazier, that after the phone died, 2 of them turned off their radios. They had those long walkie-talkies with the coil and the radio things up here. You could see them turn theirs off. And there was this duffel bag right in front of us from the building. There was a duffel bag, a police bag, and the radio went off. And it was a guy from here where the trailer was, and he said, yeah, we sent the ambulance to the back gate. And the back gate's the truck house driveway. So if you go down there, you'll see that there's cement blocks up at the end of that driveway to prevent access for a vehicle to go up there. The first 2 responders that came were mother and daughter, and they were more like just first responders that probably midnight called or up late. They showed up, and they tried to get in here. The security told them that they couldn't open this, so they had to take the back entrance. And I guess that's when we heard it on the radio, because we were up there. And so the first responders came, and they had to walk around the fence going through the rocks in the channel area. And one of them asked for permission to open the fence on the dike so that they have a walkway to walk the boy out. And the security said no, and then I kind of took the lead up there, and I told the security, I was like, it's not up to you anymore, it's up to them to decide what mm-hmm. what's to happen here. And
someone's life is on the line.
Yeah, so end up walking and opening the the fence. There was this big blue one, so I opened that up. And then it was a smaller, like a farming fence, like the one you see outside. I jumped on that one and stomped it down. And finally the ambulance came, and like they carried him out of there. And all that was done, dealt with. They got him out, so. So 7 o'clock came. It was around like 6:40 something. The two, the older security, were walking to the fence and they're gonna fix it. And that was a good timing for me, so I put my phone on. I ran up the dike, and you could watch this on my YouTube channel too. And I start recording, and I was like, "What happened here?" And they're like, "Oh, we had an incident with Sean." And I was like, "Sean who?" "Sean Davenport." And I was like, "Who called 911?" They did. And I was like, who's they, us? Yeah. So I took that video, and I knew that the company had to put a press release about this this incident. I didn't stop there too. I called OH&S on them, Occupation Health and Safety. And I got a hold of the officer of Occupation Health and Safety. Her name's Esther. And I told her the whole story. I said, "This company here is gassing people, and I just saved a life. I just called 911, and she even checked the reports out too, and she had to do an investigation and all that. And so when Alton released their statement about what happened here, they lied in their statement saying that the boy suffered from flu-like symptoms and that they called 911. So immediately after they did that, I posted the video on Facebook and YouTube. All my time I stayed at the truck house, I annoyed the hell out of the company or the security people by asserting my rights with traps and eel pods and annoying them back. Like after Sean Davenport, we were all good to each other. The security, we're all nice. Even we were feeding them like from the gatherings, leftovers, and even lobster and you name it, pizza. But after the Sean Davenport, the security people became like trying to charge us, summons us, PPAs. So after that, I just started picking on them back, telling them, "You don't touch that generator without gloves on, hard hat, safety goggles and boots." Yeah. And if they did, I call OH&S right there. I just tell Esther, I said, "Yeah, I'm watching them right now," and they stop doing what they're doing, go back in their little shanty and talk about it. To a point they even had meetings in that little shanty with the boss, and the boss is telling them off, saying, "You guys gotta follow these rules." It's the law. And if yeah, I just gave them such a hard time. They were so mad at me, and they probably still are. That's when the security was last here, was end of that, right before or after New Year's. That's when they packed up and left.
So they're gone. Security, they don't have a trailer here anymore?
Nope. Took over. Once they left, put the camp out here. You can look at my YouTube channel too. I'm celebrating. I'm walking down here and I'm pointing the camera at myself and I'm smiling, and I'm coming right at this fence, and the lady here, Don, and that the older gentleman that was with him, I'm like telling them, I said, "Can I have your hay? What are they doing with your truck house?" I'm teasing them, calling their trailer their truck house, because they copied me with the straw bales around the house for insulation, because they're going to tough it out all winter here, but they didn't have what it took, I guess.
So now that since they've been gone, like what's like a typical day out here for you? How do you spend a typical day?
Just chilling, smoking, and drinking coffee, talking to my animals, and whoever shows up.
But you got like a pretty big garden I've seen, and like a few little structures around the camp set up.
Yeah, I got a greenhouse attached to this house, straw built house. It goes pretty much around it, one half. Then the other one quarter of it is a woodshed. And then outside is 12 by 30 foot long garden, a raised bed garden made with the stones from the site here, from rocks from the ditch. I like to say it all the time that Alton donated all this stuff. Everything they put here, they donated it to us. So the gravel for this floor was donated by Alton. The rocks for the wood stove was donated by Alton. The mud and the sand and the hay was all donated by Alton, we'll say that much.
They're going to want a tax receipt.
Yeah, I'm going to sue them for watching their buildings 24/7. They owe me a lot of money. Last I counted was 680 hours. Mm-hmm. Plus, they also owe me a thank you letter for saving Sean's life and an apology for falsifying information. Oh, and then the last time I really got a PPA was a few months ago out here.
What does that stand for?
Property Protection Act.
Okay.
So it's like a warning of some sort, and if you stick around it, they can start pursuing charges. Mm. But that doesn't work out here because we're abiding by the treaty, and we're not trespassing on unceded Mi'kmaq territory. It's impossible to trespass. Like, you could put signs up down the roads, say no trespassing on these cornfields, but that doesn't exist in the Mi'kmaq's mind because we abide by the... This is our sovereignty, our law right here. It's supreme law. It's higher than the Canadian law. Mm-hmm. It doesn't exist. Canadian law does not exist in my mind. Maybe for other people it does, but I don't... Not for me. So anyway, I just told them, give me my PPA, and I took mine, I crumbled it, and I started eating it. And then, but the guy, he's laughing in the back, one of the security, and he's like, I know he was going to ask this question. He said, how does it taste? And immediately I responded by saying, it tastes like freedom. And I was like, ah, blah, blah, blah. And, yeah, it was like more of a, it was comical, like that whole event. I kind of turned it into more of a comical moment than a stressful moment. Mm-hmm. Let's just say it was funny. Made a lot of people laugh. And I told them, I'll go to court when I can sign to see the date on there, and it might take, I don't know how long it takes to digest this, and then so plant a tree, so when I told them. Which we did, we planted a tree. Black ash out there that's endangered. Mm-hmm. It's really endangered. It's one of our that we depended on a lot for everything, like money and food and trade and goods and all that. That's part of the treaty trade. And that tree was wiped out of here because, you know, that was our livelihood. We went from trading furs to getting educated forcefully to you gotta be independent, which was, you know, making baskets and hockey sticks and bowls or whatever, maybe axe handles. Then that tree got kind of wiped out. I found this place where you can go buy any kind of trees, and they happen to have black ash, and put it up in the garden. Mm-hmm. And hopefully, like, if they ever try to shut this down and there's tree hugger groups out there that want to protect this endangered tree, they'll come and surround it.
Mm-hmm. So what do you see happening next? Like, what do you expect in the near future?
It's like a 50-50 toss-up in my head. I know this project is very, very, very important to the fracking industry and the shipping industry, because they're going to turn our place, they want to turn Nova Scotia into a warehouse for gas and oil, and they want to ship it from here to BC, and this project would be their main infrastructure to bring the frackers here to frack the gas and to store it. Mm-hmm. While they ship it, and until they get a pipeline all the way from BC to here. And they put a moratorium on fracking in Nova Scotia. But there's the loophole. They want to use the municipality. Geisbro is actually the one who are having a meeting Thursday, a debate on frack gas. And they already had this discussion, and they voted on this, saying that they don't want it. They're going municipality to municipality, seeing which one would want the fracking. And that's all it takes. It's just one of them to agree. And I can guarantee you that one of these municipalities is going to have a corrupt leader in there, and he's not going to include all the no votes to fracking, and they're going to say, yeah, our people here want fracking, bring it. Either way, they're going to have to give up this project and go try to do that somewhere else, fracking and Alton gas storage and BP drilling and all that. Or they're going to try one more time with police force. And the only way they can really do that is through injunction. How do they do that when we have a treaty that's backing us up and it's more higher and it's more stronger than the Supreme Court of Canada? I don't know. And like, we've been at this for like over 2 years now. I'm pretty sure all our chiefs know what's going on here and what we're doing. I would like to see them here supporting us, but I know they can't because they signed these MOIs that gave them a lot of money because they consulted with the First Nations people and they got their consent and they got all that money from oil and gas, and they're told not to talk about these resistance camps or anything grassroots. Or they all signed on those. You could look up the PDFs and see all these the First Nations signatures on them.
From the Indian Act Chiefs?
Indian Act Chiefs, yeah. And they knew these things were coming. They didn't talk to their people about it because nobody knew. And the ones that did know sounded crazy on the internet trying to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Just made... I'm a good example because I did a lot of that stuff, like barking online, calling out the chiefs, and it just gets you nowhere. Makes you look more of a troublemaker than a truther or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I figured out the best way to get people's attention is doing this. You don't even really need Facebook for it, but it helps. Wake people up. You don't go and shake them and say, the world's falling apart, it's time to water protect. You know, that's the wrong way of doing things, I think. You can ask for help, but you got to be polite and you got to be nice, and you can't just scare away people saying, oh, they're talking about bringing injunctions here. They're going to bring them tomorrow, and then that's just a rumor, and stuff like that. And then that's like, even just a little bit of fear like that of going to jail. Or there's some people that come here and they don't even do too much here, but they got like charges already of, and PPAs, some of them. And yeah, like, people don't want to go through that misery, that road. Life's too good. No, my family and their grandparents and so on, they sacrificed so that their children could live a better life than what they went through. And like the residential school survivors, my father did all that just so that we can have a better life. And I try to do that for my kids, but like I said, I don't have too much fear about the future because I know what's going to happen. I don't know how it's going to play out. I just know it's going to be okay. So I'm not too worried. And for this fight, I'm not too worried because it's meant to happen. Things got to take its place, whether we like them or not. We learn from our mistakes. That's it. Prayers are probably the most powerful thing we got right now. It won't get you in trouble, but it will help a lot of people. And right now the world needs a lot of help and support. And there's multiple ways you can do it. Acknowledging, sharing a Facebook post, visiting, and sending letters, but we don't have a mailing address here. Even a text. Even like doing what we're doing. going, you stop something, I'll be fucking bowing down to you guys. It'll be like, yeah, you're my heroes. Mm-hmm. And that's how I look at Una Stone. I looked up to them before I even came here. Because what they were doing was like, yeah, I could understand that, like, from someone who didn't do too much of what's going on here at the time. Looking at those camps was like very inspiring to mm-hmm. the Una Stone camp. I've been following them for a while. I know there's a rumor going on about them getting an injunction, but that's a rumor. And that's like a fear, that's like fear mongering. And that happens a lot, fear mongering. Even our own people do it, it's crazy. They're still there, they're still holding it down. It's been what? Fuck, be almost 20
years.
10 years, excuse me. And we've been at it for only 2 years. But not even like cops, and we know about those mercenaries. Mm-hmm. And like I said, it falls from other fights. Militarized police, military themselves. Here it's probably like undercover cops mm-hmm. trying to look for one little excuse to, you know, get us in trouble, but there's nothing they can do because we're not doing nothing illegal here. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing we got to protect too, is our sovereignty, our treaties. We look at our chiefs, KMKNO now, those INAC chiefs, Indianac chiefs, whatever you want to call it. They're in the framework of renegotiating our treaties, and it sounds from a certain smart people that that's extinguishing our treaties and sovereign ways to replace it with modernized treaties, which you can't do because the old ones were signed by, I would call them my ancestors, and they're in the graves. You can't wake them up and tell them to change our minds on things. So we just gotta stick with what they gave us, and that's the peace and friendship and 1752, and there's quite a bit of treaties, but the main ones I could think of are those ones, and also the Jay Treaty, and also the Watertown Treaty. And I'm gonna just say one thing about that. Watertown Treaty wasn't honored during Rexton because they did have guns. The police had guns. They actually had militarized guys in uniforms with assault rifles. And according to that treaty, Watertown, like when we're in war, when a nation comes at us with guns, that the Americans are supposed to back us up during any crisis like that. And I also heard that our own people went to Washington to talk about the Watertown Treaty. Or not Washington, sorry about that, Boston. Hmm. Because that's where it originated, in Watertown, Boston. Mm-hmm. And they went there and they told them, like, firsthand to honor the treaties, and they ignored it once again. But, and here's the other thing too. So now, a big part of why the companies and the government of Nova Scotia is honoring our treaties is because of Truth and Reconciliation. And that wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for our residential school survivors. It was a horrible thing to do, is send your kids to hell and expect them to come out normal after mm-hmm. years of going through hell. Mm-hmm. And it also affects the next generations, and it's probably going to affect them for quite a while, because I could tell you about culture shock. That hurts. Mm-hmm. Like me growing up as a kid, not knowing my language, and other kids making fun of you because you can't speak it, that hurts. Those kids' parents didn't go to residential school. That's why they have the language so well. My father and all his brothers went through that school, and all their kids can't speak the language, and that's due to culture shock. And it doesn't go start from there. It goes back and further back. So my parents drank a lot of alcohol and smoked a lot of weed and hash as a way to numb the pain, the culture shock. My dad's generation wore this mask, make themselves look like fools, because they were out to kill us. They were out to wipe us out. Genocide, mass murder. It was entertaining to this non-natives to see a drunken Indian falling around all over the streets. And you know, our people know all this. It's funny. They were told all this was going to happen, and they knew all it was going to take place. I'm very grateful, like, to have a father that went through the most hardest times. I wouldn't even want to think what he went through in residential school alone, and all that oppression growing up as a kid, and then, you know, being a father and raising a boy that couldn't speak the language, and the world is pissing him off because of oil and gas industries and the government itself, or it, the system. And, you know, I hope to God that my children understand a lot of the things that I went through as a kid, and then a lot of things that my father went through, and a lot of things that my grandfather went through. And it sucks bringing life into this world, because you know that you're bringing life into this world knowing that they're going to go through really hard times, suffering. At the time, if I only known what I know now, I probably wouldn't have had kids, knowing the way this world was going. But life is life. It's meant to be. Things are supposed to happen. We were sent down here for a reason. Mm-hmm. That's my belief, and I'm very honored doing this, and very honored of my family for playing their role in life, whether it be alcoholics, drug users, spiritualists. Being oppressed kind of puts fuel in my fire. Also, like, knowing the future is going to be all right, it's like a steady burn in my heart. And then just always thinking of the sacrifices everybody did in their lives just for water. A lot of people don't understand that water is a living thing. It's a spirit. I could tell you right now, the Shubenacadie River is a blood vessel. That's pretty obvious. It's a main river that the ocean water, twice a day, takes two breaths. And when it does that, water goes into the river, comes up, travels up these little brooks and streams. And what comes in that river with the water? Fish, the blood cells. And every day they spawn. And when the spawners spawn, they die. It's like the bad blood cells. They're the dead ones. They're no good. When you fart and sneeze, that's what you're farting and sneezing. It's those dead cells. Your skin even does that. You scratch yourself, dead cells come off. And the new cells are created. Because every day the heart beats, blood pumps through your whole body. You create these cells on every second of your life, just like the earth. And then the ecosystem is created, and habitat is born. And the river never stays still. It's always moving. In 10 years, it'll be over here. In 20 years, it'll be down back where it started. And things will grow. And it's pretty amazing. This island, this turtle island, it's a living thing. Land is a living thing. Those rocks are living things. Those minerals are living things. Organisms are living things. Air is a living thing. We fight for all of it.
Fear. across the sea. A world no more, a world unknown, a world no longer mine. Black snakes crisscross this land, destroying prairies wide.